Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. I'd like to thank all of the Phantom Astronaut patrons for supporting the show. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the show, visit phantomastronaut.com for all the different ways that you can help us continue to create. Today, I'm joined by Emily Lawhead, a curator at the Utah Museum of Fine Art and one of the editors of the International Journal for Digital Art History. Hi, Emily. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So I think this is the first time that we've been on calls together. I participated in a show that you put together with some other friends. Was that a year ago? A little over a year ago?
Must have been, yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
Really, really interesting kind of virtual exhibit where it was all, you know, works from different artists who were experimenting with AI and how that's being incorporated into their practice and stuff. And, you know, from kind of getting brought into that exhibit, I learned a little bit more about you and International Journal for Digital Art History. And I found out that you're one of the curators over in Utah at the Utah Museum of Fine Art. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about what you're currently doing and kind of how your journey brought you to it?
Yeah. So I'm the Associate Curator of Modern and Contemporary Art at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. I kind of manage the whole of the Modern and Contemporary program that happens in our kind of small to mid-sized museum. We have a really wonderful burgeoning collection of modern and contemporary art and some really exciting ways that we can engage mostly with living and working artists. I spearhead something called the SALT series at the UMFA that is a series that's based on the Matrix program that was started by some various museums a few decades ago as kind of a model. But we're kind of working in that idiom of inviting an emerging contemporary artist to have a small solo exhibition. And so it's kind of a space that we can be a little bit experimental. We can push the envelope a little bit, but we're also really interested and engaged with finding artists that are at that rate moment of their career that they're ready for their first solo museum show to kind of help to launch, you know, into a bigger career. And so we've had some really wonderful artists in the past, including Yuki Kihara, Lynette Yarumboake, and some other really fantastic artists. And so I'm kind of taking that on, spearheading as we go forward. And so that's a big part of our programming and things, but I also do all the work with our permanent collection and other kind of commissioned spaces. But I come to the UMFA by way of University of Oregon, where I did my PhD, where I specialize in contemporary art and technology intersections, and did some work with the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art there. And so, yeah.
That's awesome. You know, I come from just a family background of artists. My grandmother was a sort of abstract artist, and she eventually started getting into doing work for textiles and things like that. And my father, you know, became a fine artist. And, you know, of course, I followed in that tradition, you know, doing new media and, you know, kind of conceptual work and stuff that I've, you know, really been trying to push forward in my career. But something that I've noticed popping up on the internet, where basically I live, I think I live more in digital spaces now than I participate in physical community. And, you know, yeah. That could be good or bad. You know, who knows?
We all do more. We all have more balance,
right? So I'm like, I'm having all these conversations now with people, and I'm noticing something that maybe it's always been there. Maybe it's something that is newer. I'm not sure, because again, I'm coming from this, you know, great familiarity with art and art history, but man, there's a lot of people, and I hate to say young people, because, you know, when you say that it sounds old, but the demographically, they break down to like, you know, 18 to 22. So they are like younger people. I'm noticing these profiles really, really, really have a strong aversion to like contemporary and conceptual art versus, you know, more representational paintings and things like that. And I'm wondering, you know, what kind of experience you have with that, or if you're sort of familiar with this weird backlash that's happening.
I'm not as familiar with this, and that's kind of an interesting thing to hear about. I think that we live in a really interesting, like, technological space right now, too, and especially thinking about the generations that are coming up with the internet and, you know, with all of these bits and pieces as part of their lives. I mean, I experienced life before the internet and after the internet, and, like, kind of know what the world was like before and how, you know, have been able to, like, trace that.
Yeah,
so it's kind
same.
Of interesting to think about people that are, like, born within that digital space, and that, you know, that we are always splitting ourselves between, you know, the virtual world and the physical world, and finding community in different kind of ways and spaces. And that's kind of interesting to think about how we would then perceive art, that perhaps, especially in this, like, post-COVID world where we had to become so ingrained with the virtual and the digital spaces in order to do our lives, our work lives, our social lives, and our art lives, that there is this kind of pull back to the physical, perhaps, and that we have this, like, newfound appreciation maybe, or long for something that is, like, to really contemplate a physical painting might be something, like, that is resurfacing as something that is powerful and impactful in a way that we wouldn't have thought so in 2018 or 2019, perhaps. So it's kind of interesting to think about it in that way.
And I think that's probably one of the most insightful ways to examine this that I've noticed, and maybe it's because you're kind of, like, fresh to it, and I'm, you know, getting a bunch of, like, threads at me every day, like, this is all garbage, you know, 100 people. not about my work specifically, but just, you know, I have been, like, sticking my nose in where I know that I shouldn't, because it's the internet. But I'm wondering, like, in that space now where we're past all these things, like the sort of, like, you know, fluxus intro, you know, kind of era of the late 20th century, and, you know, video art, and then we start getting into, you know, computer art and new media art, and, you know, whatever else you want to start to call it. I'm wondering what for you is exciting conceptually in, like, the contemporary art world. Where's the new ground? Where are people going?
There's so much that can be pulled, so many different angles of that can be pulled. And I mean, I'm an art historian, so I'm always interested in finding those connections between what's happening now and how that's related to everything that came before, or what kinds of, you know, cross sections we can find that are not necessarily drawing a line of, like, you know, point A made it to point C, or those kind of direct connections. But we're always inspired by things that came before. We're always looking at the legacies of thinkers and artists and writers and, you know, producers in some way, shape, or form in the past. And so I'm always interested in finding those, like you mentioned, fluxus of, like, thinking through how these kind of earlier media movements have impacted the way that we're thinking about technology and art right now. Is very interesting to me, and kind of to try those little, to find those, like, bits and pieces and points of connection that are telling a broader story of the history of art. But what I think is really interesting about what can be done now, and kind of in the world that we're living in, of these technologies being harnessed perhaps for, you know, social justice or activist movements, or some of these, you know, we're kind of thinking about art being used in perhaps a different way because of these technologies, or becoming connected in a more global sense using these. And that's not unlike earlier activist movements, or those that are, you know, part of a social history of art, but kind of interesting to think about how these tools and things might, you know, turn us to a more community-driven or a more, you know, politically engaged sense. That's one angle that kind of comes out of all of this. You know, other things can be connected to, you know, larger movements, or it could also just be thinking through, you know, the development of a style, or really getting interested in a specific medium, or making connections, you know, across time and space, you know, that it's kind of endless possibility that we can think of once we start expanding beyond the physical and into digital. But something that I think is really interesting overall, you know, when we're thinking about this whole history, is the fact that technology is going to play some role in some way, shape, or form in everybody's practices. Whether, you know, you are a strict oil painter that kind of lives in that, you're still probably looking at inspirational images on Instagram, or you're still putting yourself out there as an artist on Instagram and, you know, thinking about how your work is going to be connected to many things. So we can't disentangle art practice from technology practice anymore. It's only to what extent the technology is a you know, fundamental component of a practice. Yeah.
I think there's something, you know, very telling about when you said that even the oil painter is going to put something on Instagram is affected, obviously, by technology and the systems that, you know, that surround just posting their work. And I'd said recently, made an article where I talked about all these people, this movement of illustrators, and they're very concerned about AI systems being trained using, you know, some of their work, right? Well, and I'm not going to get too deeply into that, but what I was interested in was that I was looking through some of the portfolios of these illustrators, and I started to, you know, come away with a sense that they don't realize that the algorithm in many ways has already sort of trained them. Because I'll go back through their portfolios and I'll look. First of all, there's a format to it, right? So it's this sort of square, you know, the very rigid kind of way to express. And then, you know, you drill deeper into that, and it's like I start to see like more exotic stuff the further I go back. And then I start to see, oh, maybe they posted a piece of artwork that's related to a well-known IP, you know, like they've drawn like a Marvel superhero or something. And then now I start to see nothing but Marvel superheroes, because that performed very well for them in their feed. And as I go and I keep scrolling up, I'm watching this like evolutionary journey that is completely influenced by how the algorithm has treated them. But I don't know. It's a wild time.
It is a wild time. And it's interesting to think too about, you know, how various platforms are also influencing this, because, you know, there's certain kinds of, you know, content restrictions or something like that, that makes perfect sense when we're thinking about societal norm, you know, or, you know, trying to keep dangerous content or something. But when we're talking in an art context, like, these platforms can't tell a difference between one or the other. And so we then also get trained about what can live on which platforms and what content is where in
Absolutely. I mean, that was kind of the thrust of that series that I had in our show last year, was that, you know, was these images that I generated with, you know, an algorithm that were specifically designed in a way, and I, you know, to sort of test out whether they would get banned by another algorithm on social media. And the ones that got banned were the ones that ended up in the show. I've kind of evolved a little bit in the work that I've been doing in the last year, looking at the AI generation almost in a data visualization sense, where, like, let's say over the past 30 years, we've collected this mass of visual information connected with text concepts. So even if you do something as rudimentary as a Google image search and you say, show me a brown dog, you're going to get a lot of pictures of a brown dog. Now, when you start to go in, you ask about a concept like poverty, right? Now you're going to start seeing this weird menu of images that are put before you, because these are things that somebody somewhere has associated with the term poverty. Mm-hmm. And through an AI image generation program, you can, which is trained on all this visual and meta textual data, you can actually create some interesting composites of what the collective consciousness has decided these concepts mean. Right. So I think that level of synthesis and analysis is really important, and it's a little bit overlooked in the conversation about how technologies like AI can affect, you know, art practices and what even is the art that comes out of that. And, you know, I don't know, it's interesting ground. It's very, very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like thinking through what we collectively are understanding, like it's almost like a mirror of how society is processing certain things in a way. And it is really interesting to think through all of the pitfalls and issues and ethical questions around this technology through something like that, because it goes back to the question always of like, what human being attached the idea of poverty to this particular image,
right?
And what their human experience that was influencing, you know, putting such a label somewhere on the internet about this image. So it's an important reflection always in this about the human beings that are behind the development of all technologies, for one, but especially these kinds of things that we end up having this strange perception of them just kind of, you know, appearing out of nowhere, and that they have some sort of control that we can't fully understand, or that it's going to take off into some realm that, which is lovely and amazing to think about in, you know, sci-fi terms. And we love our brains love to go there. But I think it's so important, and artists are at the heart of all of this, to really investigate that and to tease out some of these issues, bring them to the fore, and to ask those kinds of questions. And so I think that kind of work is super important.
I think a lot of people, changing gears just slightly, at least I see some confusion about this. I'm more familiar, but I, you know, again, you know, when you're in this and you study this stuff, it's, you know, it becomes second nature. But you said that you are curating in the modern and contemporary sections of the museum. What is the difference between modern and contemporary art in a way that is very palatable and understandable for a lay audience to understand it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a question I get all the time, and one that I think is really important one for people to think about. It's a fuzzy difference. It really depends on what region of the world that you're talking about. In the United States and Europe, we kind of consider 1945 as that marker year between modern art and contemporary art. But it depends on, you know, your region. We would consider for China, that would be 1989. Or if we're thinking about developments in Japan, like we wouldn't consider modern art to begin until 1868 when the Meiji Restoration started. So, you know, we're kind of, it depends on the region of the world that you're talking about. So there isn't one, you know, wonderful date that we can point to as a difference between the two. But I think kind of, you know, conceptually, we have this kind of course, there's this shift into modern art where we start thinking conceptually, that we have like Marcel Duchamp in Europe that's really starting to question what art could even be, and starts to create these ready-mades of the urinal and things like that, that are like, what if I put this just object on a pedestal and I sign it? And I say that that's then art, that we start to explode in a different way of thinking about what art could or couldn't be. And then when we kind of, you know, these various things are always, you know, happening all over the world in different ways and different concepts and different influences. But I think sometimes this transition into contemporary can be a fuzzy line. Like there really isn't one particular thing that happens. It's like, now we are contemporary and we're new. And partly, I think, is that everything is always new, and we don't know how to differentiate that. And so we just kind of turned into contemporary. But I think part of it is also further breaking out of that like academic tradition of training and of, you know, applying to academic programs and exhibitions and things that are kind of more formalized and like associations or things like that, and kind of exploding into this more like individualistic and, you know, process driven kind of practice that could be anything and anyone. But part of it is also tying into this historical context of changes politically or socio-politically, kind of in a global sense. So it's a weird line and it's kind of covers a whole big stretch for me, but it's kind of interesting to make those distinctions, especially in a museum context that our other curators on staff, we have a curator of European and American collections, and then we have a curator of the rest of the collection, essentially, who is a expert in archaeological material and from the Americas and also from Asia. And so we overlap. Like, there's no, like, what if something happens to be made in 1926, but is European? Like, whose collection does that end up in? And it can be fuzzy in that way, but it's part of just kind of living with the messiness that is history of the world, and then how art gets thrown into that.
It seems to me, sometimes at least, to be tied more to external factors. And I think you alluded to this a little bit. You know, I think the 1945 that you referenced is really tied to, like, sort of an endpoint for industrialization, right? I mean, it feels like that's kind of where we start to, you know, have this post-war factory 1950s, everything is, you know, coming in, you know, very easily reproduced and all that sort of thing. And, you know, reactions to that within the art community. And, you know, maybe contemporary art is tied more to some of these other technological epochs that we see, like mass communication, right? Like the ability to broadcast, you know, television, you know, everywhere in the world, or, you know, even from another planet, you know, or orbital body, right? The ability to get a, you know, television signal wherever, whenever. And then maybe even now, like, all these shifts that we've been talking about are really driven by this fruition of the internet, I guess, maybe might be the way I would say it. Because we're kind of like, we've gone through a couple of different cycles of the internet and, you know, what artistic expression looks like on them. And, you know, I don't want to speak ill of the, you know, incredibly high market value companies that control everything that we do and say online, but we're living in a really, really consolidated era of the internet compared to, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So,
yeah,
you know, I wonder where that's taking us. 'Cause I think this ties in with the Journal of Digital Art History, right? Like, I mean, what's the mission that you guys have with that publication?
Yeah, we have, I mean, we're really part of trying to bring together lots of people from the community that are thinking about, you know, doing kind of art historical work in digital ways. And that could be from the lens of, you know, even studying, you know, 18th century portraiture, but what's helpful in identifying certain figures, maybe there's some sort of algorithmic tool that is helpful for that type of research. So there's a lot of historians that are interested in using digital tools to address their research topics or to encompass, you know, something that they're interested in, which may or may not be a digital subject. You know, it may not be contemporary art that they're interested in, but there might be some sort of research tool that is helpful. And this is something that's pretty well established in other types of research outside of the humanities that really are using various kinds of digital methodologies and things like that. So it's kind of a recent, you know, relatively recent method for art historians to really think about how digital technologies can help research. But at the same time, we're interested in, you know, supporting the production of digital art and you know, the flip side of that coin, which is the born digital, you know, subject in the first place. And so a lot of this work is very, as is the internet, and is a lot of the kind of digital communities are spread all around the world, that there's, you know, there's not like one local center like there have been in the art world, you know, that like New York is the center of art production, or Paris before was the center of art production. We're really like exploded into this really distributed way of working and thinking. So a lot of the community that's invested in these topics are spread around the world. So when Harold and Liska first founded the journal in 2015, they really wanted to be some sort of connecting glue for all of these folks that are thinking about it by way of a journal publication. And we've expanded since then to include a virtual gallery to feature digital artists and other kind of community gathering sources so that all of these people don't feel like we're just speaking into the void about our interests and our connections, because there may or may not be somebody even in your city that is, you know, in this field, working in this kind of niche world. And so we got to find those points of connection across the world in order to keep doing the good work.
I'm always curious, or at least I've become curious as the years go on. Like, when I first started getting on the internet in, the early 90s, and you were very, very limited in, you know, in terms of what you could produce artistically and distribute. You know, there were limitations on colors, there were limitations on, you know, size for bandwidth, things like that. And there was a lot of radical experimentation that was happening with things like, you know, web-based virtual reality and, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, what keeps me awake at night sometimes is wondering how much of that chunk of culture from maybe 1990 to 2003, 2004 is just completely evaporated with no record of it and no way to resurrect it, or there isn't really going to be a digital archaeology methodology that will be able to revitalize it the same way that we can visit, you know, physical archaeological sites, is there?
Yeah. And that is a huge piece of what I also keeps me up at night, of how my brain has thought about these things, that like the medium of digital art, especially the very early bits and pieces from the emergence of the internet and, you know, early computer art as well, in a more kind of analog sense, are in the highest danger of becoming just not being in the world anymore. As far as any medium, it's the most unstable, it's the most dangerous kind of piece. You know, we can preserve a physical painting or a physical sculpture for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, especially one that's like in a museum collection already and being cared for in that way. But, you know, we find archaeological material all the time. But the bits and pieces that are digital are so fleeting in the whole history of art. And we've lost huge pieces of new media art history because of that, that, you know, it's amazing when we do have some sort of documentation, at least, that we look to these other mediums, somebody's, you know, oral record of experiencing something or another. You know, we might have a review written of an exhibition. We might have, you know, some of the early like net art pieces that were on like listservs and things like that. Like, where are those? Like, somebody may have figured out printing them out and saving them, and they might be in a physical file somewhere, but we don't have that digital record anymore. So it's thinking through that concept of documentation and what things are at the core of what needs to live on for the future. But that's only for those that are really thinking about that in this moment, which is very few artists are thinking about, you know, what their work is going to look like in 150 years. Because why would they have to be thinking about that necessarily? Like,
that always blows my mind. Like, I don't know. Maybe I think about it too much. I'm always worried about like, is this too ephemeral? Is this, you know, how am I going to repurpose this or preserve it in some way? And like, I, as an artist, and I always just stick that onto other artists and assume that they're doing the same mental gymnastics, but I guess not.
Yeah, it's interesting the kind of different conversations that I've had. And sometimes artists are very happy for the work to just be ephemeral and disappear into the void. And that's okay too. But finding a plan and really talking that through in a different way than we ever had to ask painters or sculptors to think about that. You know, like, we never had a work come out of, you know, Jackson Pollock's studio and us be like, so how do you want us to approach this work in 150 years? You know, like, that conversation never really happened. So it's kind of a new frame, I think, for including that in the conversation. But because of it too, museums are particularly afraid of these types of artwork because we have this directive to care for them for all time. When a work is going to enter like officially into the permanent collection, like we have that public trust that this will be available for future generations to enjoy. And if we don't have the resources or the structure or something to guarantee that like an app is going to be available for, you know, three generations from now, then they're very hesitant to even think about acquiring such a work into the collection. But by extension of that, we lose a big piece of art history in that story because they're not there in the first place. And finding a balance of that is tricky. I think that museums are just now becoming comfortable with like video. Like, I think
you're right. I know
that, you know, we're like, okay, we've got to figure out what screen to get and we've got to figure out exactly that. And I think we're starting to as a whole collectively to feel comfortable with that. But if we're thinking about something that uses AR or VR or, you know, bigger than that, if we're thinking about NFTs or we're thinking about AI pieces that live on the internet and don't become a physical object, like those are really tricky if you don't have like the technological expertise on staff to think through them, which most museums don't have those kinds of resources.
I've wondered if an artist, you know, is concerned with this, if there's some value to creating it as an object in itself so that it's, let's say that it's something that's meant to be. But here's a good example. So I use in my work sometimes these, they're called hologram fans. I'm sure you've seen them. They're like the spinning, they've got a bunch of LEDs on them and they, you know, kind of create this illusion of a three-dimensional image when viewed from certain angles. And, you know, they come in various sizes or whatever. But to get the work onto these pieces of hardware, you know, I have to convert it to a really weird format. And then I have to load it onto a memory card. Then I have to put each memory card into a bespoke unit and whatever else. And at the end of it, I'm just like, okay, well, this whole piece, if this was to sell, it's not necessarily the digital material alone. It's like, you're just taking the entire thing and you know, you have to maintain the entire apparatus in some way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I don't know if that's the best approach, but that's how I've been thinking about it lately.
Yeah. I mean, I think I wouldn't want any artist to like completely change their approach because of a preservation concern. Unless it was something that like, that actually really worked with the project. And if it was a huge value, that it'd be something that can be, you know, preserved for much longer. But yeah, I think it's part of the conversation of like when something gets produced, like to ask those questions and to have that conversation of like, what do I want this to look like in 1 year, in 5 years, in 20 years, in 100 years? Like, and which of those is the most important? And
oh, absolutely.
You know, so it's the exercise of actually asking those questions is the most valuable part, I think, that it's not necessarily, you don't have to have a plan of what technology is going to look like in 100 years. Like, nobody's going to have that plan. But if there's intentional and thoughtful engagement with those questions at the stage, like, that is what the best thing is that we can do.
I think, you know, new media and conceptual work challenges people, not just on the level of the work, but on, you know, these other foundational questions that we're asking, right? I think I was talking with somebody the other day who was saying, you know, like, well, how can you, you know, or they had a very specific definition for art. And I was asking, well, how do you have such a narrow definition of art? You know, art can be many different things. And, you know, they were like, well, no, you know, I saw, you know, a picture and this painting is art, right? And I go, okay, well, let's look at this example. And I used the gates from Christo and Jean-Claude from back 20 years ago at Central Park.
Yeah.
And I asked the question, and I go, okay, well, they were asking like, well, who's the artist? What is the art? And, you know, I started breaking it down and I was like, all right, well, we have, you know, Christo and Jean-Claude who conceptualized putting in these arches with this, you know, specific fabric to follow along the pathways in Central Park. So are they the artist? Is the artist, this is of course by their metrics, because they were very much like, well, the artist is the one who paints it. Like, well, let's throw all that out the window, because, you know, Christo and Jean-Claude created this concept, but they didn't design Central Park. Yet this follows the pathways already laid out in Central Park. So did the designers of Central Park play a hand in this artwork? Did the construction people who built the arches themselves, are they the artist? Well, we typically agree that they're not. You know, and then once it all gets taken down, the only thing that really lives on from it is the pre-production materials and the documentation, which I believe was put out as a book. Now, that's an interesting thing there too, because essentially the only thing that exists of it is the documentary material, the photography, the video, right? That's how it will be remembered and contextualized. And I think that some of these more exotic internet-based projects, you know, whatever they may be, however they populate, like I've seen like the ever-changing NFT and, you know, different kinds of projects like that, the documentation is really all that's going to be able to exist. It's not going to be able to be recreated. It is by nature only a creature of its time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we should not necessarily consider those to be ugly stepchildren of the artwork, that we're thinking about how all of this.
Well, I think it's an integral part of the artwork. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it becomes, you know, we have the artwork and then we have all of these things that would be in the textbook or that would be, you know, the example image or something like that becomes our understanding of what this thing was in an interesting way. And so we have to accept that that's, you know, the evolution in the lifespan of some of these artworks. But we can't all have, you know, at the OMFA, we have a Solowit drawing in our collection. And that's one that, like, the actual artwork in the collection that we accessioned is a piece of paper with the instruction of how to draw the particular pattern in graphite on the wall. Okay. And do, you know, we have it up on the wall and we do credit on the label the folks that interpreted and, you know, actually physically put the piece on the wall. But we, you know, the name at the top of the label is Solowit. And that's something that can be iterated, you right. know, if it, you know, deteriorates over time, you know, we could paint over it and do it again. Like we could, and that's perfectly fine with how the artwork exists.
It's very much like this other thing that drives people insane the last couple of years. People know it as the banana duct tape on the wall. It's actually called the comedian. And, you know, the whole nature of that is the idea, because, you know, every couple of weeks or whatever it is, you know, they put up a new banana, you know, they refresh the duct tape. I mean, it's constantly being recreated. I think a couple of people have eaten the banana off the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
So really the idea, you know?
Yeah. But it's also, you know, thinking art historically, again, not unlike a lot of the work that was being done in like Fluxus or like Yoko Ono had her apple. And, you know, a lot of these works and a lot of these ideas are steeped in other pieces of art history, and thinking through how we can apply some of those ideas and concepts of perhaps preservation or documentation or something like that is a really good model. Like we've come across these thought experiments many times before. So like, how can we make that, you know, match to what's happening in the digital sphere? Is, you know, we have a lot of those tools already and those resources already at our disposal from looking at our history. And it's a matter of thinking through them in different media.
How does an artist, because I get this question a lot and nobody ever wants to hear from me when I tell them, you know, they're like, no, well, you're not a museum curator, so I don't want to hear from you. Well, now I have one right here on the show. So emerging artists, newer artists, they're always, you know, wondering like, well, how do I get on the radar, like institutional curation? What, maybe you can walk us a little bit through that process from the opposite side.
Yeah. And this is always, you know, the biggest question. Absolutely. And, you know, for me, trying to to find all of the amazing work that's being done is also a challenge. You know, I'm like, how do I find the most amazing, innovative artists that are pushing the limits on all of these things? And so, you know, to some extent, I have the same thoughts just on the other side. Of course, I, you know, have the traditional route of having good relationships with galleries and gallerists that are, you know, seeking out representation of artists that are ready for that stage in their career. And then they, you know, let me know when they've found somebody really interesting, or, you know, once they know what I'm interested in or the kind of curatorial projects that I have coming up, that they might say, hey, I met this great artist and I've been working with them, and, you know, I think that they should be on your radar. And that's always super helpful and wonderful. But not all artists go through that, like, very institutional version of the system. And so trying to find those, you know, points of contact are also super important to me, that I don't want to always go through, like, the formal gallery structure or something like that, because not all artists exist in that space. And in that sense, you know, I use the internet or social media or something like that to, you know, get connected to artists that I really love and have relationships with those artists and get to know their circles as well, that get expanded in that sense. And so it's kind of an alchemy too. You know, you got to find when there's a really great, you know, shared interest or shared value of something that's coming up. But I'm always very excited to do studio visits with artists or to host them, you know, if they're coming through and want to visit the museum. You know, those kinds of things are always good, just to know the sphere. And there may or may not be a project, you know, immediately happening, or, you know, a lot of the spaces that I curate and programs that I do, like, I will invite an artist to participate in that program versus doing an open call, which is, you know, open call versions and spaces exist in lots of different realms, not always in my realm, but trying to find that balance of, you know, finding those that are thinking about similar things at the similar time that you are, and making dreams come true in those kinds of, you know, exhibit terms. But for me, it's really building the relationships with the artists and being a part of that world is the biggest thing for me. And then who knows what might happen, you know, years down the line.
You know, when I teach, and people would ask me these kinds of questions too, I try really hard to dispel this myth. It's a very powerful myth that institutions, be them, you know, galleries, museums, art spaces, whatever, you know, along the spectrum, anything that's, you know, established, is by design off limits to them. And, you know, I try to tell my students, I go, well, actually, you know, these things are meant to be part of the artistic community. They want to be part of the artistic community. They want to support the artistic community. That means that you shouldn't necessarily be afraid of reaching out to them and saying, hi, you know, be nice. Don't be pushy. Don't be, you know, don't be weird. But, you know, there's like no, there, you know, this imaginary, like, invisible wall doesn't really exist. And I think when people start to break that down, you know, obviously you don't want to get 100,000 emails from people like, show my art, but, you know, it's like, yeah, if somebody's in a city and they've got an art museum and they've got whatever, and, you know, they're starting their art practice and they, you know, want to have a conversation with somebody, you know, I've never had an issue, you know, calling that museum or, you know, reaching out to a curator and just introducing myself and just saying, hi, you know, you don't even have to, you know, not everyone's going to have time to spend time with you one-on-one or whatever it is, but nobody's going to say, oh, that person emailed me, they're off the list. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes. No, never would that happen. And I mean, like, I exist in the world of working with living artists, and I love working with living artists. So I'm always happy to, like, get connected to those. And part of it too is understanding the art ecosystem in wherever you are, that there are always arts councils and art spaces that are, you know, for, you know, there's just different versions of opportunities out there. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to reach out to the curator of the biggest museum nearby just to see if they might take your work. You know, you can start with wherever feels comfortable to start with, and just being part of that ecosystem and being, you know, building those relationships with the broader community, like, you will start to get to know everybody. The art world is small. Like, it's big, but it's also, it's a tight community. Anybody that, you know, all the time we have projects come up that we're like, okay, wait, this came from this colleague. And, oh, I know this person, and I know that person, and I know this person. So, you know, part of just being in the ecosystem of the art world, wherever you are, is such a valuable thing that I've gotten to know here in Salt Lake so many wonderful artists that live and work here just by, you know, being at the openings of all the various events that happen and being engaged with their programming and, you know, having those conversations. And so I've gotten to know lots of artists in that way that we're just all doing the same thing. We're all nerds when it comes to art stuff, and we all want to know each other.
It is. It's true. It's, you know, even globally,
yep,
the art world is a very, very small community. Like, there's this good friend of mine, not necessarily a mentor, but he's older than me. And, you know, he's been a somebody that I correspond with, and we talk frequently, Australian artist named Ian Millis. And he helped to found this organization down in Australia called the Kando School of Cultural Adaptation. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it.
Uh-oh.
But what they focus on is a lot of, like, land use as art, right? And, you know, how they can create sort of these functional environmental spaces that communicate something about culture. And, you know, if you go through their materials, I brought this up just to, on my page, just so I could, like, make sure that I was saying this correctly. So the idea of cultural adaptation, this is from their site, takes its lead from Australian philosopher Donald Brook, who had some interesting things to say about the modern structures of art. Brook pointed out that creative and experimental acts have been occurring for longer than we have had the institutions that currently define art. It says, mm-hmm. Indeed, human culture would never evolve unless such things were occurring in all streams of life. He suggests that we should expand our understanding of art to include any activity that enables humans to discover new ways of acting in the world. In other words, any activity that changes culture. And I always thought that was such an elegant and beautiful way to define art, especially mm-hmm. in areas like contemporary art and digital art, where we're really stretching the definitions of what most people consider to be artistic expression.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. How do you think, do you have any sort of definitions on what you consider to be art or not, or how do you define it for yourself?
Yeah, I know. It's one of those big questions that
it's the question,
you know,
isn't
the
it?
Biggest possible question that, you know, we spend our time
unanswerable art world, you know, question that we always ask ourselves.
That's like, you know, answering a million emails and feeling like I'm in a bureaucratic swamp. It's like, what is this for? What am I doing? And, you know, we also kind of, I think about the fact that we're kind of at the tippy top of the needs pyramid, you know,
yeah.
That we're only doing all of this because we have, you know, certain resources and, you know, stability to be able to think lofty thoughts and just be talking about art all day long, which is amazing, and that we can do that. But I always think about art as records of whatever the current moment is. Like, we're really, art is always responding to and creating, you know, the cultural consciousness around history. Like, those are always fully interconnected, that we have various, you know, developments in art that are responding, like, to developments in technology, that we can't see a separation between, you know, the development of broadcast TV and video art or something like that, that we're always responding to the world around us. And whether or not an artist is going to be thinking in political or activist terms or something like that, we're still part of a current moment. And everything that we're doing and thinking and creating is in that current moment, whether that's in somebody's personal life or if it's in, like, the global sense or if it's in the local sense or a national sense. And so I always just think about how art is always a record of the now.
On that note, I think that's a great place for us to end, because that's it's a very bold, definitive statement, and I really like it. I have to contemplate that a little bit.
Yeah. So,
Emily, where can people find out more about everything that you're involved in?
You can check out the Utah Museum of Fine Arts on socials and on our website, the International Journal of Digital Art History, also on socials and website. And I'm on Instagram at mlawhead.
Thank you for joining me today, Emily. I really appreciate it. I hope we can have you back soon.
Of course. Thanks.
Visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways that you can help us to continue to create. And I will see you out there.